over the hours that followed, the ease with which I abdicated responsibility, my utter failure to consider that Andy might have been in serious trouble, was a lapse that's likely to haunt me for the rest of my life. Around 3:30 p.m., I left the South Summit ahead of Mike, Yasko, and Andy, and almost immediately descended into a dense layer of clouds. Light snow started to fall. I could scarcely tell where the mountain ended and where the sky began in the flat, diminishing light. It would have been very easy to blunder off the edge of the ridge and never be heard from again. And the conditions only worsened as I moved down the peak. At the bottom of the rock steps on the southeast ridge, I stopped with Mike to wait for Yasko, who was having difficulty negotiating the fixed ropes. He attempted to call Rob on the radio, but Mike's transmitter was working only intermittently, and he couldn't raise anybody. With Mike looking after Yasko, and both Rob and Andy accompanying Doug Hansen, the only other client still above us, I assumed the situation was under control. So as Yasko caught up to us, I asked Mike's permission to continue down alone.
"Fine," he replied. "Just don't walk off any cornices."
About 4:45 p.m., when I reached the balcony, the promontory at 27,600 feet on the southeast ridge, where I'd sat watching the sunrise with Ong Dorji, I was shocked to encounter Beck Weathers, standing alone in the snow, shivering violently. I'd assumed that he'd descended to Camp 4 hours earlier.
"Beck," I exclaimed, "what the fuck are you still doing up here?"
Years earlier, Beck had undergone a radial keratotomy to correct his vision. Note: a radial keratotomy is a surgical procedure to correct myopia, in which a series of spoke-like incisions are made from the outer edge of the cornea toward its center, thereby flattening it. End of note. A side effect of the surgery, he discovered early in the Everest climb, was that the low barometric pressure that exists at high altitude caused his eyesight to fail. The higher he climbed, the lower the barometric pressure fell, and the worse his vision became. The previous afternoon, as he was ascending from Camp 3 to Camp 4, Beck later confessed to me, "My vision had gotten so bad that I couldn't see more than a few feet, so I just tucked right behind John Taskey, and when he'd lift a foot, I'd place my foot right in his boot print." Beck had spoken openly of his vision problem earlier, but with the summit in reach, he neglected to mention its increasing severity to Rob or anyone else. His bad eyes notwithstanding, he was climbing well and feeling stronger than he had since the beginning of the expedition, and he explained, "I didn't want to bail out prematurely." Climbing above the South Col through the night, Beck managed to keep up with the group by employing the same strategy he'd used the previous afternoon, stepping in the footsteps of the person directly in front of him. But by the time he reached the balcony and the sun came up, he realized his vision was worse than ever. In addition, he'd inadvertently rubbed some ice crystals into his eyes, lacerating both corneas. At that point, Beck revealed, one eye was completely blurred over, I could barely see out of the other, and I'd lost all depth perception. I felt that I couldn't see well enough to climb higher without being a danger to myself or a burden to someone else, so I told Rob what was going on.
"Sorry, pal," Rob immediately announced. "You're going down. I'll send one of the Sherpas down with you."
But Beck wasn't quite ready to give up his summit hopes. I explained to Rob that I thought there was a pretty good chance my vision would improve once the sun got higher and my pupils contracted. I said I wanted to wait a little while and then boogie on up after everybody else if I started seeing more clearly. Rob considered Beck's proposal, then decreed, "Okay, fair enough. I'll give you half an hour to find out, but I can't have you going down to Camp 4 on your own. If your vision isn't better in 30 minutes, I want you to stay here so I know exactly where you are until I come back from the summit. Then we can go down together. I'm very serious about this. Either you go down right now, or you promise me you'll sit right here until I return." "So I cross my heart and hope to die," Beck told me good-naturedly as we stood in the blowing snow and waning light. "And I've kept my word, which is why I'm still standing here."
Shortly after noon, Stuart Hutchison, John Taskey, and Lou Kosciuszko had gone past on their way down with Lakpa and Kami, but Weathers elected not to accompany them. "The weather was still good," he explains, "and I saw no reason to break my promise to Rob at that point." Now, however, it was getting dark, and conditions were turning grim.
Come down with me, I implored. It will be at least another 2 or 3 hours before Rob shows up. I'll be your eyes. I'll get you down, no problem.
Beck was nearly persuaded to descend with me when I made the mistake of mentioning that Mike Groom was on his way down with Yasko a few minutes behind me. In a day of many mistakes, this would turn out to be one of the larger ones.
Thanks anyway, Beck said. I think I'll just wait for Mike. He's got a rope. He'll be able to short rope me down.
Okay, Beck, I replied. It's your call. I guess I'll see you in camp then.
Secretly, I was relieved that I wouldn't have to deal with getting back down the problematic slopes to come, most of which were not protected by fixed lines. Daylight was waning, the weather was worsening, my reserves of strength were nearly gone. Yet I still didn't have any sense that calamity was around the corner. Indeed, after talking with Beck, I even took the time to find a spent oxygen canister that I'd stashed in the snow on the way up some 10 hours earlier. Wanting to remove all my trash from the mountain, I stuffed it into my pack with my other two bottles, one empty, one partially full, and then hurried toward the South Col, 1,600 feet below. From the balcony, I descended a few hundred feet down a broad, gentle snow gully without incident, but then things began to get sketchy. The route meandered through outcroppings of broken shale blanketed with 6 inches of fresh snow. Negotiating the puzzling, infirm terrain demanded unceasing concentration, an all but impossible feat in my punch-drunk state. Because the wind had erased the tracks of the climbers who'd gone down before me, I had difficulty determining the correct route. In 1993, Mike Groom's partner, Lobsang Tsering Bhutia, a skilled Himalayan climber who was a nephew of Tenzing Norgay's, had taken a wrong turn in this area and fallen to his death. Fighting to maintain a grip on reality, I started talking to myself out loud. Keep it together, keep it together, keep it together, I chanted over and over, mantra-like. You can't afford to fuck things up here. This is way serious. Keep it together. I sat down to rest on a broad, sloping ledge, but after a few minutes, a deafening boom frightened me back to my feet. Enough new snow had accumulated that I feared a massive slab avalanche had released on the slopes above. But when I spun around to look, I saw nothing. Then there was another boom, accompanied by a flash that momentarily lit up the sky, and I realized I was hearing the crash of thunder. In the morning, on the way up, I'd made a point of continually studying the route on this part of the mountain, frequently looking down to pick out landmarks that would be helpful on the descent, compulsively memorizing the terrain. Remember to turn left at the buttress that looks like a ship's prow. Then follow that skinny line of snow until it curves sharply to the right. This was something I'd trained myself to do many years earlier, a drill I forced myself to go through every time I climbed, and on Everest, it may have saved my life. By 6 p.m., as the storm escalated into a full-scale blizzard with driving snow and winds gusting in excess of 60 knots, I came upon the rope that had been fixed by the Montenegrins on the snow slope 600 feet above the col. Sobered by the force of the rising tempest, I realized that I'd gotten down the trickiest ground just in the nick of time. Wrapping the fixed line around my arms to rappel, I continued down through the blizzard. Some minutes later, I was overwhelmed by a disturbingly familiar feeling of suffocation, and I realized that my oxygen had once again run out. 3 hours earlier, when I'd attached my regulator to my third and last oxygen canister, I'd noticed that the gauge indicated that the bottle was only half full. I'd figured that would be enough to get me most of the way down, though, so I hadn't bothered exchanging it for a full one. And now the gas was gone. I pulled the mask from my face, left it hanging around my neck, and pressed onward, surprisingly unconcerned. However, without supplemental oxygen, I moved more slowly, and I had to stop and rest more often. The literature of Everest is rife with accounts of hallucinatory experiences attributable to hypoxia and fatigue. In 1933, the noted English climber Frank Smith observed two curious-looking objects floating in the sky, directly above him at 27,000 feet. One possessed what appeared to be squat, underdeveloped wings, and the other a protuberance suggestive of a beak. They hovered motionless, but seemed slowly to pulsate.
In 1980, during his solo ascent, Reinhold Messner imagined that an invisible companion was climbing beside him. Gradually, I became aware that my mind had gone haywire in a similar fashion, and I observed my own slide from reality with a blend of fascination and horror. I was so far beyond ordinary exhaustion that I experienced a queer detachment from my body, as if I were observing my descent from a few feet overhead. I imagined that I was dressed in a green cardigan and wingtips. And although the gale was generating a wind chill in excess of 70 below zero Fahrenheit, I felt strangely, disturbingly warm. At 6:30, as the last of the daylight seeped from the sky, I'd descended to within 200 vertical feet of Camp 4. Only one obstacle now stood between me and safety, a bulging incline of hard, glassy ice that I would have to descend without a rope. Snow pellets borne by 70-knot gusts stung my face. Any exposed flesh was instantly frozen. The tents, no more than 650 horizontal feet away, were only intermittently visible through the whiteout. There was no margin for error. Worried about making a critical blunder, I sat down to marshal my energy before descending further. Once I was off my feet, inertia took hold. It was so much easier to remain at rest than to summon the initiative to tackle the dangerous ice slope, so I just sat there as the storm roared around me, letting my mind drift, doing nothing for perhaps 45 minutes. I'd tightened the drawstrings on my hood until only a tiny opening remained around my eyes, and I was removing the useless frozen oxygen mask from beneath my chin when Andy Harris suddenly appeared out of the gloom beside me. Shining my headlamp in his direction, I reflexively recoiled when I saw the appalling condition of his face. His cheeks were coated with an armor of frost, one eye was frozen shut, and he was slurring his words badly. He looked in serious trouble. "Which way to the tents?" Andy blurted, frantic to reach shelter. I pointed in the direction of Camp 4, then warned him about the ice just below us. "It's steeper than it looks," I yelled, straining to make myself heard over the tempest. "Maybe I should go down first and get a rope from camp." As I was in mid-sentence, Andy abruptly turned away and moved over the lip of the ice slope, leaving me sitting there, dumbfounded. Scooting on his butt, he started down the steepest part of the incline. "Andy," I shouted after him, "it's crazy to try it like that. You're gonna blow it for sure." He yelled something back, but his words were carried off by the screaming wind. A second later, he lost his purchase, flipped ass over tea kettle, and was suddenly rocketing headfirst down the ice. 200 feet below, I could just make out Andy's motionless form slumped at the foot of the incline. I was sure he'd broken at least a leg, maybe his neck. But then, incredibly, he stood up, waved that he was okay, and started lurching toward Camp 4, which at the moment was in plain sight, 500 feet beyond. I could see the shadowy forms of 3 or 4 people standing outside the tents. Their headlamps flickered through curtains of blowing snow. I watched Harris walk toward them across the flats, a distance he covered in less than 10 minutes. When the clouds closed in a moment later, cutting off my view, he was within 60 feet of the tents, maybe closer. I didn't see him again after that, but I was certain that he'd reached the security of camp, where Chuldom and Arita would doubtless be waiting with hot tea. Sitting out in the storm, with the ice bulge still standing between me and the tents, I felt a pang of envy. I was angry that my guide hadn't waited for me. My backpack held little more than 3 empty oxygen canisters and a pint of frozen lemonade. It probably weighed no more than 16 or 18 pounds. But I was tired and worried about getting down the incline without breaking a leg, so I tossed the pack over the edge and hoped it would come to rest where I could retrieve it. Then I stood up and started down the ice, which was as smooth and hard as the surface of a bowling ball. 15 minutes of dicey, fatiguing crampon work brought me safely to the bottom of the incline, where I easily located my pack, and another 10 minutes after that, I was in camp myself. I lunged into my tent with my crampon still on, zipped the door tight, and sprawled across the frost-covered floor, too tired to even sit upright. For the first time, I had a sense of how wasted I really was. I was more exhausted than I'd ever been in my life. But I was safe.
Andy was safe. The others would be coming into camp soon. We'd fucking done it. We'd climbed Everest. It had been a little sketchy there for a while, but in the end, everything had turned out great. It would be many hours before I learned that everything had not, in fact, turned out great. That 19 men and women were stranded up on the mountain by the storm, caught in a desperate struggle for their lives. Chapter 15. Summit. 1:25 p.m., May 10, 1996. 29,028 feet. There are many shades in the danger of adventures and gales, and it is only now and then that there appears on the face of facts a sinister violence of intention, that indefinable something which forces it upon the mind and the heart of a man that this complication of accidents or these elemental furies are coming at him with a purpose of malice, with a strength beyond control, with an unbridled cruelty that means to tear out of him his hope and fear, the pain of his fatigue and the longing for rest, which means to smash, to destroy, to annihilate all he has seen, known, loved, enjoyed, or hated, all that is priceless and necessary, the sunshine, the memories, the future, which means to sweep the whole precious world utterly away from his sight by the simple and appalling act of taking his life. Joseph Conrad, Lord Jim. Neil Beidelman reached the summit at 1:25 p.m. with client Martin Adams. When they got there, Andy Harris and Anatoly Bukharev were already on top. I had departed 8 minutes earlier. Assuming that the rest of his team would be appearing shortly, Beidelman snapped some photos, bantered with Bukharev, and sat down to wait. At 1:45, client Clev Schoening ascended the final rise, pulled out a photo of his wife and children, and commenced a tearful celebration of his arrival on top of the world. From the summit, a bump in the ridge blocks one's view of the rest of the route, and by 2 o'clock, the designated turnaround time, there was still no sign of Fisher or any other clients. Beidelman began to grow concerned about the lateness of the hour. 36 years old, an aerospace engineer by training, he was a quiet, thoughtful, extremely conscientious guide who was well-liked by most members of his team and Hall's. Beidelman was also one of the strongest climbers on the mountain. 2 years earlier, he and Bukharev, whom he considered a good friend, had climbed 27,824-foot Makalu together in near-record time, without supplemental oxygen or Sherpa support. He first met Fisher and Hall on the slopes of K2 in 1992, where his competence and easygoing demeanor left a favorable impression on both men. But because Beidelman's high-altitude experience was relatively limited, Makalu was his only major Himalayan summit, his station in the Mountain Madness chain of command was below Fisher and Bukharev, and his pay reflected his junior status. He'd agreed to guide Everest for $10,000, compared to the $25,000 Fisher paid Bukharev. Beidelman, sensitive by nature, was quite conscious of his place in the expedition pecking order. "I was definitely considered the third guide," he acknowledged after the expedition. "So I tried not to be too pushy. As a consequence, I didn't always speak up when maybe I should have, and now I kick myself for it." Beidelman said that according to Fisher's loosely formulated plan for the summit day, Lopsang Jangbu was supposed to be at the front of the line, carrying a radio and 2 coils of rope to install ahead of the clients. Bukharev and Beidelman, neither of whom was given a radio, were to be in the middle or near the front, depending on how the clients were moving, and Scott, carrying a second radio, was going to be sweep. At Rob's suggestion, we decided to enforce a 2 o'clock turnaround time. Anybody who wasn't within spitting distance of the summit by 2 p.m. had to turn around and go down. "It was supposed to be Scott's job to turn clients around," Beidelman explained. "We'd talked about it. I'd told him that as the third guide, I didn't feel comfortable telling clients who'd paid $65,000 that they had to go down. So Scott agreed that would be his responsibility. But for whatever reason, it didn't happen." In fact, the only people to reach the summit before 2 p.m. were Bukharev, Harris, Beidelman, Adams, Schoening, and me.
If Fisher and Hall had been true to their prearranged rules, everyone else would have turned back before the top. Despite Beidelman's growing anxiety about the advancing clock, he didn't have a radio, so there was no way to discuss the situation with Fisher. Lopsang, who did have a radio, was still somewhere out of sight below. Early that morning, when Beidelman had encountered Lopsang on the balcony, vomiting between his knees into the snow, he'd taken the Sherpa's two coils of rope to fix on the steep rock steps above. As he now laments, however, it didn't even occur to me to grab his radio, too. The upshot, Beidelman recalled, is that I ended up sitting on the summit for a very long time, looking at my watch and waiting for Scott to show, thinking about heading down, but every time I stood up to leave, another one of our clients would roll over the crest of the ridge, and I'd sit back down to wait for them. Sandy Pittman appeared over the final rise about 2:10, slightly ahead of Charlotte Fox, Lopsang Jangbu, Tim Madsen, and Lenny Gammelgaard. But Pittman was moving very slowly, and shortly below the summit, she abruptly dropped to her knees in the snow. When Lopsang came to her assistance, he discovered that her third oxygen canister had run out. Early in the morning, when he'd started short-roping Pittman, he'd also cranked her oxygen flow as high as it would go, 4 liters per minute, and consequently, she'd used up all her gas relatively quickly. Fortunately, Lopsang, who wasn't using oxygen himself, was carrying a spare oxygen canister in his pack. He attached Pittman's mask and regulator to the fresh bottle, and then they ascended the last few meters to the top and joined the celebration in progress. Rob Hall, Mike Groom, and Yasko Namba reached the summit around this time, too, and Hall radioed Helen Wilton at base camp to give her the good news.
"Rob said it was cold and windy up there," Wilton recalled, "but he sounded good. He said, 'Doug is just coming up over the horizon. Right after that, I'll be heading down. If you don't hear from me again, it means everything's fine.'"
Wilton notified the Adventure Consultant's office in New Zealand, and a flurry of faxes went out to friends and families around the world, announcing the expedition's triumphant culmination. But Doug Hansen wasn't just below the summit at that point, as Hall believed, nor was Fisher. It would in fact be 3:40 before Fisher reached the top, and Hansen wouldn't get there until after 4 p.m. The previous afternoon, Thursday, May 9th, when all of us had climbed from Camp 3 to Camp 4, Fisher hadn't reached the tents on the South Col until after 5 p.m., and he was visibly tired when he'd finally gotten there, although he did his best to disguise his fatigue from his clients. "That evening," recalled his tent mate, Charlotte Fox, "I couldn't tell that Scott might have been sick. He was acting like Mr. Gung-ho, getting everyone psyched up like a football coach before the big game." In truth, Fisher was exhausted from the physical and mental strain of the preceding weeks. Although he possessed extraordinary reserves of energy, he'd been profligate with those reserves, and by the time he got to Camp 4, they were nearly depleted.
"Scott strong person," Bukharev acknowledged after the expedition, "but before summit attempt is tired, has many problems, spend lots of power. Worry, 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 worry. Scott nervous, but he keep inside."
Fisher hid the fact from everyone, as well, that he may have been clinically ill during the summit attempt. In 1984, during an expedition to Nepal's Annapurna Massif, he'd been stricken with a mysterious disease that had degenerated into a chronic liver condition. Over the years, he'd consulted numerous doctors and undergone batteries of medical tests, but a definitive diagnosis was never forthcoming. Fisher simply referred to his affliction as a liver cyst, told few people about it, and tried to pretend that it was nothing to worry about. "Whatever it was," says Jane Bromett, one of the handful of intimates who knew about the ailment, "it produced malaria-like symptoms, even though it wasn't malaria. He would break into these intense sweating spells and get the shakes. The spells would lay him low, but they would only last for 10 or 15 minutes and then pass. In Seattle, he'd get the attacks maybe once a week or so, but when he was stressed, they'd occur more frequently. At base camp, he was getting them more often, every other day, sometimes every day." If Fisher suffered such attacks at Camp 4 or above, he never mentioned it. Fox reported that soon after he crawled into their tent Thursday evening, Scott conked out and slept really hard for about 2 hours. When he woke up at 10 p.m., he was slow getting ready, and he remained in camp long after the last of his clients, guides, and Sherpas departed for the summit. It's unclear when Fisher actually left camp for, perhaps as late as 1 a.m. on Friday, May 10th. He dragged far behind everyone else through most of the summit day, and he didn't arrive at the South Summit until around 1 p.m. I first saw him around 2:45 on my way down from the top while I waited on the Hillary Step with Andy Harris for the crowd to clear out. Fisher was the last climber up the rope, and he looked extremely wasted. After we exchanged pleasantries, he spoke briefly with Martin Adams and Anatoly Bukharev, who were standing just above Harris and me, waiting to descend the step. "Hey, Martin," Fisher bantered through his oxygen mask, trying to affect a jocular tone. "Do you think you can summit Mount Everest?" "Hey, Scott," Adams replied, sounding annoyed that Fisher hadn't offered any congratulations. "I just did." Next, Fisher had a few words with Bukharev. As Adams remembered the conversation, Bukharev told Fisher, "I am going down with Martin." Then Fisher plodded slowly on toward the summit, while Harris, Bukharev, Adams, and I turned to rappel down the step. Nobody discussed Fisher's exhausted appearance. It didn't occur to any of us that he might be in trouble. At 3:10 Friday afternoon, Fisher still hadn't arrived on top, says Beidelman, adding, "I decided it was time to get the hell out of there, even though Scott hadn't showed up yet." He gathered up Pittman, Gamelgard, Fox, and Madsen, and started leading them down the summit ridge. 20 minutes later, just above the Hillary Step, they ran into Fisher. "I didn't really say anything to him," Beidelman recalls. "He just sort of raised his hand. He looked like he was having a hard time, but he was Scott, so I wasn't particularly worried. I figured he'd tag the summit and catch up to us pretty quick to help bring the clients down." Beidelman's primary concern at the time was Pittman. Everybody was pretty messed up by that point, but Sandy looked especially shaky. I thought that if I didn't keep real close tabs on her, there was a good chance she'd peel right off the ridge. So I made sure she was clipped into the fixed line, and in the places where there was no rope, I grabbed her harness from behind and kept a tight hold on her until she could clip into the next section of rope. She was so out of it that I'm not even sure she knew I was there. A short distance below the south summit, as the climbers descended into thick clouds and falling snow, Pittman collapsed again and asked Fox to give her an injection of a powerful steroid called dexamethasone. Dex, as it is known, can temporarily negate the deleterious effects of altitude. Each member of Fisher's team carried a pre-prepared syringe of the drug in a plastic toothbrush case inside his or her down suit, where it wouldn't freeze for emergencies. "I pulled aside Sandy's pants a little," Fox recalls, "and jammed the needle into her hip, right through her long underwear and everything." Beidelman, who had lingered at the south summit to inventory oxygen, arrived on the scene to see Fox plunging the syringe into Pittman, stretched out face down on the snow. "When I came over the rise and saw Sandy lying there, with Charlotte standing over her waving a hypodermic needle, I thought, 'Oh fuck, this looks bad.' So I asked Sandy what was going on, and when she tried to answer, all that came out of her mouth was a bunch of garbled babble." Extremely concerned, Beidelman ordered Gamelgard to exchange her full oxygen canister with Pittman's nearly empty one, made sure her regulator was turned to full flow, then grabbed the semi-comatose Pittman by her harness and started dragging her down the steep snow of the southeast ridge. "Once I got her sliding," he explains, "I'd let go and glissade down in front of her. Every 50 meters I'd stop, wrap my hands around the fixed rope, and brace myself to arrest her slide with a body block. The first time Sandy came barreling into me, the points of her crampons sliced through my down suit. Feathers went flying everywhere." To everyone's relief, after about 20 minutes, the injection and extra oxygen revived Pittman, and she was able to resume the descent under her own power. Around 5 p.m., as Beidelman accompanied his clients down the ridge, Mike Groom and Yasko Namba were arriving at the balcony some 500 feet below them. From this promontory at 27,600 feet, the route veers sharply off the ridge to the south toward Camp 4. When Groom looked in the other direction, however, down the north side of the ridge, through the billowing snow and faltering light, he noticed a lone climber badly off route. It was Martin Adams, who'd become disoriented in the storm and mistakenly started to descend the Kangshung face into Tibet. As soon as Adams saw Groom and Namba above him, he realized his mistake and climbed slowly back toward the balcony. Martin was out of it by the time he got back up to Yasko and me, Groom recalls. His oxygen mask was off, and his face was encrusted in snow. He asked, "Which way to the tents?" Groom pointed, and Adams immediately started down the correct side of the ridge, following the trail I'd blazed perhaps 10 minutes earlier. While Groom was waiting for Adams to climb back up to the ridge, he sent Namba down ahead and busied himself trying to find a camera case he'd left on the way up. As he was looking around, for the first time, he noticed another person on the balcony with him. Because he was sort of camouflaged in the snow, I took him to be one of Fisher's group, and I ignored him. Then this person was standing in front of me saying, "Hi, Mike," and I realized it was Beck. Groom, just as surprised to see Beck as I had been, got out his rope and began short-roping the Texan down toward the south call. Beck was so hopelessly blind, Groom reports, that every 10 minutes he'd take a step into thin air and I'd have to catch him with the rope. I was worried he was going to pull me off many times. It was bloody nerve-wracking. I had to make sure I had a good ice axe belay and that all my points were clean and sticking into something solid at all times. One by one, following the tracks I'd made 15 or 20 minutes earlier, Beidelman and the remainder of Fisher's clients filed down through the worsening blizzard. Adams was behind me, ahead of the others. Then came Namba, Groom and Weathers, Schoening and Gamelgard, Beidelman, and finally Pitman Fox and Madsen. 500 feet above the south call, where the steep shale gave way to a gentler slope of snow, Namba's oxygen ran out, and the diminutive Japanese woman sat down, refusing to move. "When I tried to take her oxygen mask off so she could breathe more easily," says Groom, "she'd insist on putting it right back on. No amount of persuasion could convince her that she was out of oxygen, that the mask was actually suffocating her. By now, Beck had weakened to the point where he wasn't able to walk on his own, and I had to support him on my shoulder. Fortunately, right about then, Neil caught up to us." Beidelman, seeing that Groom had his hands full with Weathers, started dragging Namba down toward Camp 4, even though she wasn't on Fisher's team. It was now about 6:45 p.m., and almost completely dark. Beidelman, Groom, their clients, and two Sherpas from Fisher's team who had belatedly materialized out of the mist, Tashi Chering and Nawang Dorji, had coalesced into a single group. Although they were moving slowly, they had descended to within 200 vertical feet of Camp 4. At that moment, I was just arriving at the tents, probably no more than 15 minutes in front of the first members of Beidelman's group. But in that brief span, the storm abruptly metastasized into a full-blown hurricane, and the visibility dropped to less than 20 feet. Wanting to avoid the dangerous ice pitch, Beidelman led his group on an indirect route that looped far to the east, where the slope was much less steep, and around 7:30, they safely reached the broad, gently rolling expanse of the South Col. By then, however, only 3 or 4 people had headlamps with batteries that hadn't run down, and everyone was on the brink of physical collapse. Fox was increasingly relying on Madsen for assistance. Weathers and Namba were unable to walk without being supported by Groom and Beidelman, respectively. Beidelman knew they were on the eastern Tibetan side of the col and that the tents lay somewhere to the west, but to move in that direction it was necessary to walk directly upwind into the teeth of the storm. Wind-whipped granules of ice and snow struck the climbers' faces with violent force, lacerating their eyes and making it impossible to see where they were going. "It was so difficult and painful," Schoening explains, "that there was an inevitable tendency to bear off the wind, to keep angling away from it to the left, and that's how we went wrong." "At times you couldn't even see your own feet, it was blowing so hard," he continues. I was worried somebody would sit down or get separated from the group, and we'd never see them again. But once we got to the flats of the call, we started following the Sherpas, and I figured they knew where camp was. Then they suddenly stopped and doubled back, and it quickly became obvious they didn't have any idea where we were. At that point, I got a sick feeling in the pit of my stomach. That's when I first knew we were in trouble. For the next 2 hours, Beidelman, Groom, the two Sherpas, and the seven clients staggered blindly around in the storm, growing ever more exhausted and hypothermic, hoping to blunder across the camp. Once they came across a couple of discarded oxygen bottles, suggesting that the tents were near, but the climbers couldn't locate them. "It was total chaos," says Beidelman. "People are wandering all over the place. I'm yelling at everyone, trying to get them to follow a single leader. Finally, probably around 10 o'clock, I walked over this little rise, and it felt like I was standing on the edge of the earth. I could sense a huge void just beyond." The group had unwittingly strayed to the easternmost edge of the col, at the lip of a 7,000-foot drop down the Kangshung face. They were at the same elevation as Camp 4, just 1,000 horizontal feet from safety. "But," says Beidelman, "I knew that if we kept wandering in the storm, pretty soon we were going to lose somebody." Note: although a strong climber might require 3 hours to ascend 1,000 vertical feet, in this case, the distance was over more or less flat terrain, which the group would have been able to cover in perhaps 15 minutes had they known where the tents were. End of note. I was exhausted from dragging Yasuko. Charlotte and Sandy were barely able to stand. So I screamed at everyone to huddle up right there and wait for a break in the storm. Beidelman and Schoening searched for a protected place to escape the wind, but there was nowhere to hide. Everyone's oxygen had long since run out, making the group more vulnerable to the wind chill, which exceeded 100 below zero. In the lee of a boulder no larger than a dishwasher, the climbers hunkered in a pathetic row on a patch of gale-scoured ice. "By then the cold had about finished me off," said Charlotte Fox. "My eyes were frozen. I didn't see how we were going to get out of it alive. The cold was so painful, I didn't think I could endure it any more. I just curled up in a ball and hoped death would come quickly." "We tried to keep warm by pummeling each other," Weathers remembers. "Someone yelled at us to keep moving our arms and legs. Sandy was hysterical. She kept yelling over and over, 'I don't want to die. I don't want to die.' But nobody else was saying a whole lot." 300 yards to the west, I was shivering uncontrollably in my tent, even though I was zipped into my sleeping bag and wearing my down suit and every other stitch of clothing I had. The gale threatened to blow the tent apart. Every time the door was opened, the shelter would fill with blowing spindrift, so everything inside was covered with an inch-thick layer of snow. Oblivious to the tragedy unfolding outside in the storm, I drifted in and out of consciousness, delirious from exhaustion, dehydration, and the cumulative effects of oxygen depletion. At some point in the evening, Stuart Hutchison, my tentmate, came in, shook me hard, and asked if I would go outside with him to bang on pots and shine lights into the sky in the hope of guiding the lost climbers in, but I was too weak and incoherent to respond. Hutchison, who had gotten back to camp at 2 p.m. and was thus considerably less debilitated than me, then tried to rouse clients and Sherpas from the other tents. Everybody was too cold or too exhausted, so Hutchison went out into the storm alone. He left our tent 6 times that night to look for the missing climbers, but the blizzard was so fierce that he never dared to venture more than a few yards beyond the margin of camp. "The winds were ballistically strong," he emphasizes. "The blowing spindrift felt like a sandblaster or something. I could only go out for 15 minutes at a time before I became too cold and had to return to the tent." Out among the climbers hunkered on the eastern edge of the col, Beidelman willed himself to stay alert for a sign that the storm might be blowing itself out. Just before midnight, his vigilance was rewarded when he suddenly noticed a few stars overhead and shouted to the others to look. The wind was still whipping up a furious ground blizzard at the surface, but far above, the sky had begun to clear, revealing the hulking silhouettes of Everest and Lhotse. From these reference points, Clev Schoening thought he'd figured out where the group was in relation to Camp 4. After a shouting match with Beidelman, he convinced the guide that he knew the way to the tents. Beidelman tried to coax everyone to their feet and get them moving in the direction indicated by Schoening, but Pittman, Fox, Weathers, and Namba were too feeble to walk. By then it was obvious to the guide that if somebody from the group didn't make it to the tents and summon a rescue party, they were all going to die. So Beidelman assembled those who were ambulatory, and then he, Schoening, Gamelgard, Groom, and the two Sherpas stumbled off into the storm to get help, leaving behind the four incapacitated clients with Tim Madsen. Reluctant to abandon his girlfriend, Fox, Madsen selflessly volunteered to stay and look after everybody until help arrived. 20 minutes later, Beidelman's contingent limped into camp, where they had an emotional reunion with a very worried Anatoly Bukharev. Schoening and Beidelman, barely able to speak, told the Russian where to find the five clients who'd remained behind out in the elements, and then collapsed in their respective tents, utterly spent. Bukharev had come down to the South Call hours in front of anyone else in Fisher's team. Indeed, by 5 p.m., while his teammates were still struggling down through the clouds at 28,000 feet, Bukharev was already in his tent, resting and drinking tea. Experienced guides would later question his decision to descend so far ahead of his clients, extremely unorthodox behavior for a guide. One of the clients from that group has nothing but contempt for Bukharev, insisting that when it mattered most, the guide cut and ran. Anatoly had left the summit around 2 p.m. and quickly became entangled in the traffic jam at the Hillary Step. As soon as the mob dispersed, he moved very rapidly down the southeast ridge without waiting for any clients, despite telling Fisher atop the step that he would be going down with Martin Adams. Bukharev thereby arrived at Camp 4 well before the brunt of the storm. After the expedition, when I asked Anatoly why he had hurried down ahead of his group, he handed me the transcript of an interview he'd given a few days previously to Men's Journal through a Russian interpreter. Bukharev told me that he'd read the transcript and confirmed its accuracy. Reading it on the spot, I quickly came to a series of questions about the descent, to which he had replied, "I stayed on the summit for about an hour. It is very cold, naturally. It takes your strength. My position was that I would not be good if I stood around freezing, waiting. I would be more useful if I returned to Camp 4 in order to be able to take oxygen up to the returning climbers or to go up to help them if someone became weak during the descent. If you are immobile at that altitude, you lose strength in the cold, and then you are unable to do anything." Bukharev's susceptibility to the cold was doubtless greatly exacerbated by the fact that he wasn't using supplemental oxygen. In the absence of gas, he simply couldn't stop to wait for slow clients on the summit ridge without courting frostbite and hypothermia. For whatever reason, he raced down ahead of the group, which in fact had been his pattern throughout the entire expedition, as Fisher's final letters and phone calls from base camp to Seattle made clear. When I questioned him about the wisdom of leaving his clients on the summit ridge, Anatoly insisted that it was for the good of the team. "It is much better for me to warm myself at South Call, be ready to carry up oxygen if clients run out." Indeed, shortly after dark, after Beidelman's group failed to return and the storm had risen to hurricane intensity, Bukharev realized they must be in trouble and made a courageous attempt to bring oxygen to them. But his stratagem had a serious flaw. Because neither he nor Beidelman had a radio, Anatoly had no way of knowing the true nature of the missing climber's predicament, or even where on the huge expanse of the upper mountain they might be. Around 7:30 p.m., Bukharev left Camp 4 to search for the group regardless. By then, he recalled, "Visibility was maybe a meter. It disappeared altogether. I had a lamp, and I began to use oxygen to speed up my ascent. I was carrying 3 bottles. I tried to go faster, but visibility was gone. It is like being without eyes, without being able to see. It was impossible to see. That is very dangerous,
because one can fall into a crevasse. One can fall toward the southern side of Lhotse, 3,000 meters straight down. I tried to go up. It was dark. I could not find the fixed line.
Some 600 feet above the col, Bukharev recognized the futility of his effort and returned to the tents. But, he admits, he very nearly became lost himself. In any case, it was just as well that he abandoned this rescue effort, because at that point his teammates were no longer on the peak above, where Bukharev had been headed. By the time he gave up his search, Beidelman's group was actually wandering around on the col 600 feet below the Russian. When he arrived back at Camp 4 around 9 p.m., Bukharev was worried about the 19 climbers who were missing, but because he had no idea where they might be, there was nothing he could do except bide his time. Then, at 12:45 a.m., Beidelman, Groom, Schoening, and Gamelgard hobbled into camp. Klev and Neil had lost all power and could barely talk, Bukharev recalls. They told me Charlotte, Sandy, and Tim need help. Sandy is close to dying. Then they give me general location where to find them. Upon hearing the climbers arrive, Stuart Hutchison went out to assist Groom. I got Mike into his tent, Hutchison recalled, and saw that he was really, really exhausted. He was able to communicate clearly, but it required an agonal effort, like a dying man's last words. You have to get some Sherpas, he told me. Send them out for Beck and Yasko. And then he pointed toward the Kangshung side of the col. Hutchison's efforts to organize a rescue team proved fruitless, however. Choldum and Arita, Sherpas on Hall's team who hadn't accompanied the summit party and were waiting in reserve at Camp 4 specifically for such an emergency, had been incapacitated with carbon monoxide poisoning from cooking in a poorly ventilated tent. Choldum was actually vomiting blood. And the other four Sherpas on our team were too cold and debilitated from having gone to the summit. After the expedition, I asked Hutchison why, once he learned the whereabouts of the missing climbers, he didn't attempt to wake Frank Fishbeck, Lou Kosicki, or John Taske, or make a second attempt to wake me, in order to request our help with the rescue effort. It was so obvious that all of you were completely exhausted that I didn't even consider asking. You were so far past the point of ordinary fatigue that I thought if you attempted to help with a rescue, you were only going to make the situation worse, that you would get out there and have to be rescued yourself. The upshot was that Stuart went out into the storm alone, but once again he turned around at the edge of camp when he became worried that he wouldn't be able to find his way back if he went farther. At the same time, Bukharev was also trying to organize a rescue team, but he didn't contact Hutchison or come to my tent, so the efforts of Hutchison and Bukharev remained uncoordinated, and I never learned of either rescue plan. In the end, Bukharev discovered, like Hutchison, that everybody he managed to rouse was too sick or exhausted or frightened to help. So the Russian resolved to bring back the group on his own. Bravely plunging into the maw of the hurricane, he searched the col for nearly an hour, but was unable to find anybody. Bukharev didn't give up. He returned to camp, obtained a more detailed set of directions from Beidelman and Schoening, then went out into the storm again. This time he saw the faint glow of Madsen's fading headlamp and was thereby able to locate the missing climbers. They were lying on the ice without movement, says Bukharev. They could not talk. Madsen was still conscious and largely able to take care of himself, but Pittman, Fox, and Weathers were utterly helpless, and Namba appeared to be dead. After Beidelman and the others had set out from the huddle to get help, Madsen had gathered together the climbers who remained and hectored everybody to keep moving in order to stay warm. I sat Yasko down in Beck's lap, Madsen recalls, but he was pretty unresponsive by that time, and Yasko wasn't moving at all. A little later I saw that she'd laid down flat on her back, with snow blowing into her hood. Somehow she'd lost a glove. Her right hand was bare, and her fingers were curled up so tightly you couldn't straighten them. It looked like they were pretty much frozen to the bone. I assumed she was dead, Madsen continues. But then, a while later, she suddenly moved, and it freaked me out. She sort of arched her neck slightly, as if she was trying to sit up, and her right arm came up, Then that was it. Yasko lay back down and never moved again. As soon as Bukharev found the group, it became obvious to him that he could bring only one climber in at a time. He was carrying an oxygen bottle, which he and Madsen hooked up to Pittman's mask. Then Bukharev indicated to Madsen that he'd be back as soon as possible and started helping Fox back toward the tents. After they left, says Madsen, Beck was crumpled in a fetal position, not moving a whole lot, and Sandy was curled up in my lap, not moving much either. I screamed at her, "Hey, keep wiggling your hands! Let me see your hands!" And when she sits up and pulls her hands out, I see she doesn't have any gloves on, that they were dangling from her wrists. So I'm trying to shove her hands back into her gloves when all of a sudden Beck mumbles, "Hey, I've got this all figured out." Then he kind of rolls a little distance away, crouches on a big rock, and stands up facing the wind with his arms stretched out to either side. A second later, a gust comes up and just blows him over backward into the night, beyond the beam of my headlamp. And that was the last I saw of him. Tolly came back a little bit after that and grabbed Sandy, so I just packed up my stuff and started waddling after them, trying to follow Tolly's and Sandy's headlamps. By then I assumed Yasko was dead and Beck was a lost cause. When they finally reached camp, it was 4:30 a.m., and the sky was starting to brighten above the eastern horizon. Upon hearing from Madsen that Yasko hadn't made it, Beidelman broke down in his tent and wept for 45 minutes. Chapter 16, South Call, 6 a.m., May 11, 1996, 26,000 feet. I distrust summaries, any kind of gliding through time, any too great a claim that one is in control of what one recounts. I think someone who claims to understand but is obviously calm, someone who claims to write with emotion recollected in tranquility, is a fool and a liar. To understand is to tremble. To recollect is to re-enter and to be riven. I admire the authority of being on one's knees in front of the event. Harold Brodkey, Manipulations. Stuart Hutchison finally managed to shake me awake at 6 a.m. on May 11th. "Andy's not in his tent," he told me somberly. "And he doesn't seem to be in any of the other tents either. I don't think he ever made it in." "Harold's missing?" I asked. "No way. I saw him walk to the edge of camp with my own eyes." Shocked and confused, I pulled on my boots and rushed out to look for Harris. The wind was still fierce, strong enough to knock me down several times, but it was a bright, clear dawn, and the visibility was perfect. I searched the entire western half of the col for more than an hour, peering behind boulders and poking under shredded, long-abandoned tents, but found no trace of Harris. Adrenaline surged through my veins. Tears welled in my eyes, instantly freezing my eyelids shut. How could Andy be gone? It couldn't be so. I went to the place where Harris had slid down the ice just above the col, and then methodically retraced the route he'd followed toward camp, which followed a broad, almost flat ice gully. At the point where I last saw him when the clouds descended, a sharp left turn would have taken Harris 40 or 50 feet up a rocky rise to the tents. I realized, however, that if he hadn't turned left, but instead continued straight down the gully, which would have been easy to do in the whiteout, even if one wasn't exhausted and stupid with altitude sickness, he would have quickly come to the westernmost edge of the col. Below, the steep gray ice of the Lhotse face dropped 4,000 vertical feet to the floor of the western coombe. Standing there, afraid to move any closer to the edge, I noticed a single set of faint crampon tracks leading past me toward the abyss. Those tracks, I feared, were Andy Harris's. After getting into camp the previous evening, I'd told Hutchison that I'd seen Harris arrive safely at the tents. Hutchison had radioed this news to base camp, and from there it was passed along via satellite phone to the woman with whom Harris shared his life in New Zealand, Fiona McPherson. She'd been overcome with relief when she learned that Harris was safe at Camp 4. Now, however, Hall's wife back in Christchurch, Jan Arnold, would have to do the unthinkable. call McPherson back to inform her there had been a horrible mistake, that Andy was in fact missing and presumed dead. Imagining this phone conversation and my role in the events leading up to it, I fell to my knees with dry heaves, retching over and over as the icy wind blasted against my back. After spending 60 minutes searching in vain for Andy, I returned to my tent just in time to overhear a radio call between base camp and Rob Hall. He was up on the summit ridge, I learned, calling down for help. Hutchison then told me that Beck and Yasko were dead and that Scott Fisher was missing somewhere on the peak above. Shortly after that, the batteries to our radio died, cutting us off from the rest of the mountain. Alarmed that they had lost contact with us, members of the IMAX team at Camp 2 called the South African team, whose tents on the call were only a few yards away from ours. David Brashears, the IMAX leader and a climber I had known for 20 years, reports, "We knew the South Africans had a powerful radio and that it was working, so we got one of their team members at Camp 2 to call up to Woodall on the South Call and say, 'Look, this is an emergency. People are dying up there. We need to be able to communicate with the survivors in Hall's team to coordinate a rescue. Please lend your radio to John Krakauer.' And Woodall said no. It was very clear what was at stake, but they wouldn't give up their radio." Immediately after the expedition, when I was researching my article for Outside Magazine, I interviewed as many of the people on Hall's and Fisher's summit teams as possible. I spoke with most of them several times. But Martin Adams, distrustful of reporters, kept a low profile in the aftermath of the tragedy and eluded my repeated attempts to interview him until after the Outside piece went to press. When I eventually reached Adams by phone in mid-July and he consented to talk, I began by asking him to recount everything he remembered about the summit push. One of the stronger clients that day, he'd remained near the front of the pack and was either just ahead of me or just behind me for much of the climb. Because he possessed what seemed to be an unusually reliable memory, I was particularly interested to hear how his version of the events jibed with my own. Very late in the afternoon, when Adams headed down from the balcony at 27,600 feet, he said that I was still visible, perhaps 15 minutes ahead of him, but that I was descending faster than he was and soon moved out of sight. "And the next time I saw you," he said, "it was almost dark and you were crossing the flats of the South Col, about 100 feet from the tents. I recognized that it was you from your bright red down suit." Shortly after that, Adams descended to a flat bench just above the steep ice incline that had given me so much trouble and fell into a small crevasse. He managed to extricate himself, then fell into another, deeper crevasse. "Lying in that crevasse, I was thinking, 'This may be it,'" he mused. It took a while, but eventually I managed to climb out of that one, too. When I got out, my face was covered with snow, which quickly turned to ice. Then I saw somebody sitting on the ice off to the left, wearing a headlamp, so I walked over in that direction. It wasn't pitch black yet, but it was dark enough that I couldn't see the tents anymore. So I got to this fucker and said, 'Hey, where are the tents?' And the guy, whoever he was, pointed the way. So I said, 'Yeah, that's what I thought.' Then the guy said something like, 'Be careful, the ice here is steeper than it looks. Maybe we should go down and get a rope and some ice screws.' I thought, 'Fuck that, I'm out of here.' So I took 2 or 3 steps, tripped, and slid down the ice on my chest, head first. As I was sliding, somehow the pick of my ice axe caught something and swung me around. Then I came to a stop at the bottom. I got up, stumbled to the tent, and that's about the size of it." As Adams described his encounter with the anonymous climber, and then sliding down the ice, my mouth went dry and the hairs on the back of my neck suddenly bristled. "Martin," I asked when he'd finished talking, "do you think that could have been me you ran into out there?" "Fuck no," he laughed. "I don't know who it was, but it definitely wasn't you." But then I told him about my encounter with Andy Harris and the chilling series of coincidences. I had bumped into Harris about the same time Adams had encountered the cipher, and in about the same place. Much of the dialogue that transpired between Harris and me was eerily similar to the dialogue between Adams and the cipher. and then Adams had slid headfirst down the ice in much the same manner I remembered seeing Harris slide. After talking for a few minutes more, Adams was convinced. "So that